During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Dress: The History of Fashion is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast where we explore the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dressed listeners, as you know, on the podcast, April and I are dedicated to exploring and celebrating the humanity behind the clothes we wear and the threads that really connect us all throughout the past, present, and future. And today, it is more important than ever to foster a more thoughtful relationship with the clothing we wear and the people that make it so as to counteract that fast fashion world that we all know is working to destroy our planet to the tune of producing 100 billion pieces of clothing per year.
But hope is not lost. There are actually so many incredible companies, collectives, and also individuals working to remind us about the value of dress and textiles. And that includes Alabama Channon. Founded over 2 decades ago by Natalie Channon in, as you may have guessed, Alabama, the company is committed to, quote, the ideas of sustainable design, preserving craft traditions, and producing locally and ethically with the highest possible quality standards, end quote. So this goes into everything that Alabama Channon does, from the harvesting of the cotton to the making of the garment. And all of this is so incredibly thought out and really reflects their commitment to the designing and crafting of products and also their dedication to the people who make them.
Yeah, it really is such a beautiful company doing really, really important work. And they also are working to create clothing consciousness in their communities through their school, as well as their nonprofit organization Project Threadways, which supports research, including things like an oral history project and an annual symposium, which we had the distinctive honor at presenting virtually at last month. So the symposium every year brings together scholars, activists, and makers working to make the world a better place through fashion and textiles.
And this year's theme was The Future, and was intended as a conversation about a better way for future textile manufacturing. And as we do Undressed, we took this theme as an invitation to explore the history of textile manufacturing through the lens of Kashmiri shawl production, African wax-resist cottons, and triangle shirtwaist factory fire. And we did all of this with the intention of answering the question, which formed the beginning of our talk, title, Why Fashion History Matters, Lessons from the Past to Save Our Future. Without further ado, welcome to a live recording of Dressed.
April, Cassidy, we welcome you to the Threadways Symposium. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us. So my name is April Callahan.
And I am Cassidy Zachary.
And we are fashion historians, friends for a very long time, and also co-hosts and creators of Dress, the History of Fashion podcast. And we just wanted to say thank you so much to Project Threadways and also Alabama Channon for having us today. We are very pleased to be here with all of you who actually, surprise, are about to be our guest audience for an upcoming episode of Dressed. So we are recording the show here, this lecture, with you all today. So any of the questions you posed during the Q&A, et cetera, are actually going to be part of an upcoming episode. So that would be the next episode in our over 500 episodes, which we always begin the exact same way. We always say, with over 8 billion people in the world,
We all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed. That the act of dressing really speaks to our shared humanity is just one of the myriad of ways we use the podcast to explore personal, social, and the cultural significance of dress, as well as all of these threads that connect us all across the past, present, and hopefully well into the future.
And something else that we always love to say on the show is that fashion history is about more than pretty clothes. And the clothes we wear have always had significance beyond mere aesthetics. So we have done episodes that span history and the globe on everything from the male origin of the high heel in Persian horseback riding cultures to the politics of style during and after the French Revolution to the beginnings of the Vietnamese American nail salon industry during the Vietnamese War era. And with each of our episodes, we really speak to the meaning sewn into the clothes we wear and we dress and adorn our bodies with. Just as they provide a window into the past, they also have valuable lessons for us in the present.
Yeah, and that's because fashion has always been both an incredibly valued marker of status, craftsmanship, personal identity, cultural expression, and also an incredibly valuable lens with which to explore people's lives and legacies. You know, what we have worn throughout history matters, and it continues to matter today, even if people don't always recognize it and appreciate it in the same way that we have historically.
And of course, we're speaking very generally when we say that. But that disconnect today is largely thanks to fast fashion's campaign to shift consumer desire from quality to quantity. And it has in many ways damaged so many of our abilities at large to connect with and appreciate clothing and the makers of that clothing. So with this baseline expectation of overproduction and overconsumption, we are producing more garments per year than ever in history, an estimated 100 billion garments per year. And of course, we are at a sustainability conference right now. Many of you already know this, so we're not going to belabor the devastating consequences for us all, not only to the planet, but also the people who populate it and will continue to populate it well into the future.
Yeah. And Undressed, we truly believe that we can use lessons from fashion's past to inspire our listeners to be more conscious wearers and consumers of clothing in the present, and then thus hopefully work forward collectively to save our future. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to use four of our past dressed episodes as case studies to further explore that point. And within those case studies, we're going to explore two key themes at the heart of each and every episode that we produce on the podcast, and that is materials matter and people matter.
So today we live in a world where clothing has become disposable, but it was not always that way. And textiles were once so valuable as to be a currency, while entire economies have risen and fallen on the merit of its textile and fashion trades. And this was certainly the case with the first subject that we are going to discuss today, from one of our very first episodes on the podcast entitled Cashmere with the K, the Controversial History of a Shawl. So in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, cashmere shawls were coveted symbols of European luxury and high fashion before technological advances made them available en masse. So they enjoyed a popularity for the better part of 80 years, and they were immortalized in the popular imagination thanks to their omnipresence in fashion magazines, portraits, and literature. However, as you may or may not be aware, the origins of the cashmere shawl are not in fact European at all, but Kashmiri. So what you and I may know today as cashmere, C-A-S-H-M-E-R-E, is in fact the anglicized version of Kashmir, K-A-S-H-M-I-R, which is a region that borders Pakistan, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, China, Tibet, and India. Shawl production in Kashmir is thought to have begun either in the late 15th or early 16th centuries, and it really blossomed into a lucrative industry thanks in no small part to the patronage of the 16th century Mughal Emperor Akbar, who took a great interest in the finely woven shawls of the Kashmiri region. So much so that he created and oversaw imperial shawl workshops in three different cities, and he made a pair of Kashmiri shawls an indispensable part of the important kilat or robe of honor ceremony. And during this ceremony, allies of the empire were gifted a luxurious set of clothing that included not one, but two cashmere shawls. And while Kashmiri shawls employed various types of materials, including silk and cotton, they were really considered at their finest when they were made of the softest and most refined of wools known as pashm or pashmina, which is the Persian and Kashmiri word for soft hair. And this wool was sourced from the underbelly of a domesticated mountain goat found in the mountains of Tibet in Central Asia, and it was sold to Kashmiri artisans who then sorted it and spun it into yarn and then wove it into a shawl. And this intricate hand-weaving technique is known as kani, really represents the height of Kashmiri skill and craftsmanship in shawl production. And for those of you out there who are in the audience who are textile and sewing aficionados, kani is a twill tapestry weave with a double weft interlocked. And you can see it exhibited at the coat, in this coat, and in detail at right. So while the sorting and spinning of the wool was typically a job done by women, weavers were exclusively male, two or three of whom would weave together on a hand-operated shuttle-type loom. They wove designs while looking at a pattern and using a series of spools that each contained a different colored thread. With anywhere from 400 to 1,500 different spools being required, depending on the complexity of that particular shawl's designs. So as you can imagine, this was quite a laborious and intricate process, and the most luxurious of these shawls could take anywhere from 18 months to 3 years. So needless to say, these shawls were quite expensive and only enjoyed by the most affluent members of society. So this is all to say that long before Kashmiri shawls were enjoyed by fashionable ladies in Europe, they were luxury items exported from Kashmir via a sophisticated trade network to some of the most wealthy men and women across Asia and the vast Turkish Ottoman Empire. It wasn't until the 18th century, largely thanks to the British colonials' presence in nearby India, that the international market extended to Europe, where the shawls became highly coveted commodities before being knocked off by scheming manufacturers in England, France, and Scotland. And this is when Kashmir with a K becomes Kashmir with a C. And it becomes copied, these shawls become copied so much as to lose the centrality and importance of the Kashmir region to the shawl's production in favor of a narrative that centers European fashion. And we see this time and time again throughout the history of fashion. And this is no better exemplified than by the fact that the boda or bent teardrop motif that originated in the ancient city of Babylon, which is modern day Iraq, is today commonly known in the West as Paisley, named after the Scottish shawl manufacturing center prized for its Kashmir shawl knockoffs. So this was just a very brief introduction to Kashmir with a K, but it speaks to a myriad of reasons why fashion history is relevant today. Yes, it speaks to the history of colonialism and cultural appropriation, but it also serves to recenter Kashmir as the originator of one of the most coveted luxury goods in history, not just in Europe, but around the world. This painstakingly handmade fashion accessory also speaks to the universal language of cloth and how incredibly valued and valuable cloth was in the pre-industrial age, when it would have been unconscionable to wear something once or twice and discard it or throw it away. So Kashmir shawls really stand as a potent reminder that materials matter, so much so that entire cultures, histories, and exchanges are woven into their very existence. And this is something that remains true to this very day. I was so thrilled to learn, doing research for this episode, that this incredible hand craftsmanship, artistry, and skill of the Kashmiri weaver is still alive and well today. And while not the booming industry it once was, the hand-woven kani tradition has been carried into the present day by artisans who, supported by government programming and private commissions, are determined to preserve the art, heart, and history of this remarkable garment for future generations to come.
So, if the exceptional quality of the shawls of the Kashmiri region, which were sought the world over during the 19th century and really drove global trade, the story of wax print is maybe even a more complex tale of why materials matter and how textiles in particular can be repositories for history. And wax print, or Ankara, was the subject of a 2021 podcast episode called A History of Wax Print, in which we conducted an interview with the documentary filmmaker Iwan Obenbian, whose documentary Wax Print is phenomenal. It's out. You can view it now. So known by more than a few names, including Dutch wax print, Hollandaise, Ankara, African batik, there are many others. All of these terms refer to the same textile, which was made using a very specific wax resist technique used in dyeing the fabric in order to create motifs. And as a process, wax resist is an ancient technique. It's been used in many cultural traditions, but Today, our story is actually going to begin in Indonesia. And that is because from the 12th century on, Indonesian textile artists really embraced this wax resist process and refined it into an art form, particularly on the island of Java, where this very rich batik tradition had existed for centuries before the Dutch colonization of Indonesia began in the 17th century. And as soon as those Dutch colonizers got in there, particularly the merchants, they really recognized the value of this region's unique textile tradition. And they sought to profit off of it by industrializing that, which had been handmade for centuries. So by the 19th century, several companies, including Lisco, which still exists today, were producing mechanized copies of Indonesian batiks and importing them from their factories in Holland back into Indonesia. So when the Indonesian markets really failed to embrace these cheaper knockoffs, new markets had to be targeted. Initially, Sweden and Japan were two of them, but enter one industrialist merchant whose name was Ebenezer Brown Fleming, and he was the son of a pastor, and through his father's ties to missionaries working in Africa, he recognized this potential market for newly converted Africans who were adapting their dress to conform with Christianity's dictates of modesty. So it was not long before these new styles of dress that were being suggested by Christian missionaries to Africans new to Christianity began to involve Fleming's mass-produced knockoff batiks featuring Indonesian motifs. And as these textiles were increasingly embraced in the African market, the missionary middlemen who had served as the salespeople initially in the trade transitioned to becoming African middle women. And so this whole group of women was known as the Nana Bens. And in many countries, particularly in Togo, entering the wax print trade was this really great way for women to amass wealth. And not only did they become power players in the fashion identity of their own regions, they also amassed tremendous political influence. So from this point forward, this is where the story starts to take a little bit of a different turn, because African consumers began to create their own cultural associations with these fabrics. And the Nana Bens began to guide manufacturers with a design direction as to what their clients wanted. So even these Indonesian motifs, the traditional Indonesian motifs that were still being imported, were often being reassigned new meanings and symbolism within these different African marketplaces. And women in particular began to use the specific patterns as silent forms of communication. So in the 1960s, increasingly the motifs produced for import into Africa shifted away from traditional Indonesian motifs and began to speak directly to African pop culture and even political events, as many countries like Ghana, Nigeria, and Senegal struggled for their independence. And so the wearing of Ankara or Lupita or African batik, all different terms for the same thing, began to be viewed as a form of political resistance and African pride. And today, of course, this association continues throughout the world within the wider African diaspora. But also, at the same time, so continues this cycle of this textile's appropriation and production. While Lisco and other European mass producers of wax prints continue to be major players in the African marketplaces, and I also should issue a side note here, there is a really wonderful local and regional production of these textiles by African makers of Ankara, and a lot of them are doing it by hand. So it's fostering a return to the textiles roots. But the big point that I want to make here is that Chinese manufacturers have entered this market too. And they have gotten particularly good at intentional knockoffs of Lisco patterns, complete with fake stickers of authenticity, which is highly ironic. So from its roots in Indonesia, to its industrialization in Europe, to its import to the shores of the Gold Coast, and now back to China, where these wax resist techniques were thought to originate in the 8th century, wax print, or any of the other names that it goes by, has really acquired all of these histories of colonialism and trade, and it really remains this incredibly important example of how fashion and textiles regularly meet at this nexus point of cultural identity, politics, and technology. And we're going to say it once again, materials matter. Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, are you not feeling like yourself these days? Do you suspect it might be related to some of the hormonal changes all women experience? Well, then Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows.
So whether you find yourself in menopause, perimenopause, or simply experiencing racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, and feeling tired all the time, or even a low sex drive, Hormone Harmony is here to get you feeling like yourself again.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today.
Materials matter and people matter, which is why one of Dressed's core philosophies is to celebrate the makers of fashion, from more celebrated fashion designers and icons to fashion history's most hidden and underrated figures, and that includes American fashion industry pioneer Elizabeth Keckley, the subject of only our 7th ever episode of Dressed in 2018. Elizabeth Keckley was born enslaved in Virginia in the United States in 1818, and she really honed her dressmaking skills from a very young age as a matter of necessity. She learned how to sew from her mother, with whom she shared the burden of doing all of the sewing, not just for their enslavers, but the other enslaved peoples as well. But as a young woman, Elizabeth would use her mastery of garment construction to buy her and her son's freedom. She'd had a son by that point. And she bought their freedom and she moved to the nation's capital of Washington, D.C. in 1860. And it was here that she became the premier dressmaker, head of a booming Civil War era business. The merit of Elizabeth's skill earned her a reputation quickly. And it was not long before she was making dresses for the city's most prominent citizens, very notable for straddling the political divide on what was then the eve of the Civil War. So for instance, among her first clients were both the future First Lady of the Confederacy, Verena Davis, and the First Lady of the United States, Mary Todd Lincoln, to whom Elizabeth would become incredibly close. They really became best friends. And this was sadly a bond that was made stronger by their shared grief for the untimely and tragic deaths of both of their sons within a year of one another. And Elizabeth became close not just with Mary, but also Abraham Lincoln as well. And it's actually thanks to Elizabeth that many relics associated with Abraham's life survive, and that includes the bloodstained outfit that Mary was wearing when he was tragically assassinated. But I digress. In my opinion, Mary Todd Lincoln is a very underappreciated fashion icon. And she earned this status, I believe, at this time, thanks in no small part to Elizabeth's incredible skill. A well-dressed first lady was part and parcel to the White House's public image, and it was a role that Mary took very seriously. And as you can see in these images, this is the era of the cage crinoline. So Elizabeth and her staff are making these hugely expansive dresses with wide bell-shaped skirts and fitted bodices. And it's these fitted bodices that really speak to Elizabeth's particular skill. She had an impeccable ability to fit the bodice like a second skin. And for all of her 5'2 frame, Mary is always the height of fashion, in especially here in these images, in a dress tailored to perfection by Elizabeth to show off all of her attributes and none of her faults. So I have this wonderful quote from an 1862 publication that really confirms that Elizabeth was more than just a dressmaker working with her clients to create garments. She really was a well-respected and coveted tastemaker and designer of women's fashion. And the quote reads, "It is Lizzie," she went by Lizzie for all those who knew her, "it is Lizzie who fashions those splendid costumes for Miss Lincoln, whose artistic elegance has been so highly praised during the last winter. Stately carriages stand before her door, whose haughty owners sit before Lizzie, docile as lambs, while she tells them what to wear. Lizzie is an artist and has such a genius for making women look pretty that no one thinks of disputing her decrees." So very similar, very, very similar things have been said about this man at left. This is Elizabeth's contemporary, Charles Frederick Worth. And yet only one of these two designers, so Worth at left and Elizabeth at right, is heralded as a great, traditionally, I should say, is traditionally heralded as a great fashion luminary and a modern fashion designer. The other, Elizabeth, has been historically dismissed as a mere dressmaker. But Elizabeth's skills and design talents undeniably rivals that of Charles Frederick Worth and the other Parisian haute couturiers. And that's really exemplified by these two comparative images here. So at left, you have Worth client Empress Cece, dressed by Worth. And at right, you have Mary Todd Lincoln, dressed by Elizabeth. And both of these women wear impeccably crafted designs that represent the height of fashion of 1865. So incredibly similar. And the only difference is how history and historians will treat and remember the designers of their gowns. So this photograph of Mary was taken 1 month before her husband was assassinated. And the years following Lincoln's death were not kind to Mary or Elizabeth. Mary's reputation was destroyed after failing to pay. She had $250,000 in debt, and creditors came calling in droves after Lincoln's death. She could not pay it. And it was not just her reputation that was in shatters, but that of her right hand and best friend, Elizabeth, whose business by association would never recover and whose contributions to fashion history would be subsequently lost or dismissed for well over a century. It is only very recently that fashion scholars have worked to revive and restore Elizabeth to her rightful place among fashion history's great designers. She played an incredibly significant role in creating a well-documented American fashion worn by the fashion leaders in an enormously pivotal period in American history. She helped to change the face and shape of fashion against enormous odds, and by doing so, laid the foundation for a generation of Black fashion designers to follow in that path. And Diana just was mentioning Ann Lowe and Zelda Vandel Valdez. And of course, this continues into the present day and well into the future. And Elizabeth is also a potent reminder to us all that we should care about who makes our clothing, a message as important throughout history as it is in today's fast fashion world that is rife with human rights abuses. But as April is going to remind us next, this is nothing new.
Sadly, it is not. One of the main concerns at the root of, I'm sure, why many of us are here today, those of us who practice, engage with, or want to learn more about ethical fashion, are our concerns over the conditions in which many of our fellow humans endure, particularly those of us that are the most vulnerable as part of capitalism's quest to sell us more clothes. So if people matter and people make our clothes, their labor matters. And I'd really like to speak about a significant event in American history, a rather tragic event, but one that did become a rallying cry for workers' rights and also the subsequent creation of worker protection legislation all around the United States. And I am, of course, speaking about the Triangle Factory Fire of 1911, which was the subject of a recent guest episode on its anniversary a few weeks ago in late March. So just to set the scene, between the years 1824 and 1924, an estimated 34 million immigrants arrived to the United States. And many of these immigrants arrived with dressmaking or tailoring skills. But even for those who did not, the garment trades were an easy entry point for employment because the garment manufacturing was actually the fastest growing segment of industry in New York City during the 19th century or mid-19th century. So there was this massive influx of available labor into New York during the 19th century. And this really drove wages down as all of these new arrivals were competing to enter the workforce. And of course, employers were quick to exploit these immigrants' kind of situations, right? They needed to provide for themselves and their families. And oftentimes, very sadly, these offers they received were poverty-level wages. And kind of across the board, unhygienic, wildly unsafe working conditions. And these conditions, of course, increased the employer's profit margins, but the immigrants themselves had little leverage or recourse to push back. And what ended up happening is that this sweatshop system flourished. I do want to say here very briefly that in the years leading up to the fire, there were actually dedicated labor reform activists working to change this system for the benefit of the health, safety, and rates of pay for American fashion's workforce. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union was founded in 1900 and the Women's Trade League Union in 1903. And together they organized significant strikes in 1907, 1908, and 1909. But it would be the fire that broke out at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory on March 25th, 1911, that really raised public awareness and raised governmental support to make sweeping changes to labor legislation. What happened the day of the fire was horrific. We're not going to get into those gory details. They are out there on the internet if you would like to look into it yourself. But the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, which manufactured women's blouses, occupied the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of the Ash Building, which is in the Greenwich Village neighborhood of Lower Manhattan. And the fire is thought to believe after a match or a cigarette butt that was not quite out yet was tossed into a very large bin of scrap fabric. This bin probably also contained oily rags, which were used to lubricate the machines. And what happened is the spark lit a small fire in the bin that grew very quickly. And then as the flames came up from the bin, it lit the paper patterns, which were hung from the ceiling above the cutters tables, on fire. So basically the room became quickly engulfed in flames, not only from below as it spread to other bins, but also from the ceiling as well. A lot of the initial attempts to put it out failed, particularly when the fire hose, which was kept in the stairwell, did not have water pressure. And you can see in this diagram on the left, see how these work tables? Those are long, uninterrupted work tables. There's no space in between them. So it really prevented workers from escaping as quickly as they possibly could. Could you point out the exit points? Yeah. Okay. So here in the back or on the front and over here on the side, those are the two exit points. The one cast first pointed out near the number one, that had always been kept locked by the owners in direct violation of fire code. And the reason they wanted to keep that back exit locked is they wanted to funnel everybody onto the other exit because there was an inspection point there where they inspected everyone's bags to make sure that they weren't stealing garments or fabrics. So while the employees of the factory had on the eighth floor had a little bit of notice because they saw the fire start and they saw it grow, the employees on the ninth floor fared far less because they had zero warning that the fire was coming. So in the course of 30 minutes, 146 workers lost their lives. This is about a quarter of the number of employees of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. They were, of course, taken by the fire itself or smoke, or many of them actually made the fatal decision to jump out of the factory windows rather than burn. And out of those 146 who perished that day, all but 21 of them were women. And the vast majority of these women were in their teens and 20s. The youngest of them, and there were several, were only 14 years old. So As the news hit the papers the next day, New York City really went into mourning for this event. And soon that grief turned into outrage when, as a result of the investigation, it became apparent that nearly all of the employees could have escaped had that one exit not been kept locked by factory owners. So this event drew not only the attention of the public, but also factions of the New York State government to the plight that hundreds of thousands of their constituents living in their districts were garment workers. And in the fall of 1911, the New York legislature formed a factory investigation committee, which was, quote, charged with investigating factory sanitary and safety conditions, wages, and other related issues such as living conditions of its workers. The commission appointed directors for each investigation, and field agents were hired to carry out on-site inspections of factories and other work sites. Additionally, from its study of the deficiencies in labor law, the commission concluded the entire law needed reworking and that the entire Department of Labor should be reorganized, which is a big deal, right? And really, from this point forward, hundreds of labor laws were changed in New York State for not just the fashion industries, but all industries. And labor unions for the next few years saw widespread growth, not just in New York State, but across the United States. 45 years later, nationwide, by 1956, more than 35% of U.S. workers carried a union card. And today, that number is around 8%. So part of that decline in union membership has to do with a lot of different things, mainly the vast offshoring of American manufacturing that kind of tiny little bit began in the 1960s, it really ramped up in the 1980s. And then when NAFTA was passed, or the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, was passed in 1992, this was kind of a virtual death knell, as the tariffs that were imposed for import-export reasons, you know, those were really meant to keep American know-how in America. When those tariffs were eliminated, this whole system dissolved. And that's because with the draw of cheaper labor forces abroad, and vastly different labor laws abroad, if any at all, manufacturing just bailed out of the U.S. And this devastated entire towns where the majority of the economy was really dependent, or had been really dependent, on these large-scale manufacturing operations that took place locally. So a lot of these big companies, they simply vanished, and leaving behind their entire workforce. And these people just had to figure it out for themselves. Greed doesn't believe that people matter, but history tells us that people do. And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about how this whole scenario went down, highly recommend this book, which came out just a few weeks ago. It's actually called Making It in America. But the main point that I want to make here is that what is happening right now in the global fashion system is actually an aberration within history. And that is because for thousands of years, the vast majority of clothing and materials that went into them were made locally or regionally by people that the wearer probably knew. So whether that was a family member or a professional who they went to for their made-to-measure garments, which of course was the norm at the time for centuries, today those types of relationships have been lost at sea. And I say lost at sea quite literally, because it's estimated that only 3% of the clothing that Americans wear today is actually made in the U.S. So reestablishing these connections to who and how and where our clothing is made and in what conditions the workers make said clothing is a huge pillar of how we can affect change. The first two examples that we spoke about today in terms of material matters, or the materials matter, are also stories of not only cashmere and wax print themselves. They're, of course, also stories of colonization and trade. And I wonder if Americans are now reliant on imports for 97% of our clothing, and as the FDA has very publicly also stated, 85% of our food and clothing being two of the things that fulfill our most basic needs. Well, my question is this: who exactly is it that has had their resources extracted a la colonialism? It's us at this point.
So not all, but all is not lost, right? There are so many people doing the work to carry on the good lessons of the history of fashion and learning from those problematic lessons to enact change. And this is, of course, exemplified by the work being done by numerous artisans and organizations around the world, including Alabama Channon and so many other presenters at this conference, and also people like the Fashion Revolution Project, Who Made My Clothes, which was on the previous slide that reminds you to ask who made your clothing. And it also includes artists like Kirsty McLeod's 14-year living practice, and it's called the Red Dress Embroidery Project, which represents millions of stitches, the work of 380 embroiderers from 51 countries. And this is a project that reminds us that the language of clothes can actually bring us together.
So valuing the who, what, when of why we wear is but one step that we can all take and beginning to repair this aberrational moment in fashion history. And we would like to invite all of you to join us every day with this mantra: materials matter, people matter, each time you get dressed.
And that concludes our presentation. Thank you all so much.
And I think we have time for questions.
Thank you so much for this reminder and this addition to the conversation that indeed materials and people do matter. And it struck me as y'all were presenting that the project that you're involved in, sort of a public history for a younger generation to talk about kind of these stories that are not well known and to bring it into contemporary issues, bridging that popular and scholarly divide. That's a lot of what the symposium itself is attempting to do this weekend. And so we just really appreciate that. Can you tell us what you found with y'all's audience? What issues are resonating with people, who your audience is, the kind of questions and themes that they're interested in?
Well, I think one of the kind of undercurrents of the show, we definitely have an activist bent, obviously, as you can all tell. And I think one of the things, especially when we started doing episodes on sustainability and ethics and fashion, one of the things that we were really surprised at is how people simply didn't know and how many listener emails we would get. And some of them literally Cass and I have cried at because they were so touching about how just listening to the podcast has completely changed their buying habits, and not only for themselves, but their entire families. So that was one thing that we were surprised and delighted at, and we keep working towards constantly. That's never going to go away.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what I was going to say. I think we hear from people all the time about how they had never really thought of it before, but now that they have, they've just restructured their relationship with their clothing and gotten back in touch with the meaning that is embedded in our clothing, because that's just something we're constantly asking people to just consider, is the meaning in your clothes and that valuable connection that we've also lost when you just go and buy a $5 t-shirt because it was cheap. You don't have the meaning that you would with a garment that you yourself sourced or somebody made for you or you inherited from one of your family members. So we just really encourage people to be more conscious about that. And we have gotten an incredible response.
Yeah, it seems like, I imagine most of your audience is younger. Do you know the demographics of who your listeners are?
We actually have quite the age range of listeners. We do fashion history tours in Paris, and we get a small case study of our listeners. Mm-hmm. And it's people from all over the world and of all ages, too. I don't think it's ever too late to connect with the things that we talk about on dress. And I think that's one of the things that really resonates with people about our podcast, is that we do have this shared innate human connection to the clothing we wear. And I think that speaks to people in a myriad of ways.
It seems as though also you're able to use fashion as a lens for people to talk about these bigger issues of cultural appropriation and activism and capitalism and the environment and race, gender, in ways that people don't just tune out. They have a connection to their clothing that you've made explicit and daily. And so it's a way for people to examine these things. Do you guys have a favorite episode or an episode that surprised you in its popularity?
Cass, I can answer the popular one. You want to name a favorite episode?
That is so hard. One of my all-time favorite episodes was an interview that I did with a World War II combat veteran, Tony Vaccaro. It was so unexpected in that he was, a combat soldier during World War II. And after the war, he became a fashion photographer because he was looking for beauty. And he found it in fashion. And it always makes me want to cry. He just barely passed away at, I think, a 99 or 100 years old. And so it was just such a beautiful reminder about the beauty that is found in the clothing we wear and the dressed body, and that it can be a saving grace for people in so many ways too. So that's definitely one of my all-time favorite episodes.
Our most popular episode to date remains one that when I wrote it, it was just like a tiny little mini-sode, right? But it's the history of glitter. And I think that so many of us have it in our lives on a daily basis, wear it in our face. I'm wearing it right now in my makeup. But the history of glitter episode was the one that just took off and really surprised us all. Also, too, we've done a couple different episodes on the history of pockets. Both of those, a lot of reception as well. Both tie-on pockets from like the 18th and 19th century, and then also sewn-in tailored pockets as well. We've done different episodes because they're kind of like different animals.
That's so fun. Now I have to go back and find those episodes and listen along. I know we will all be mining the podcast archives to listen to our favorite episodes. Thank you for giving us a wonderful presentation and an overview of a lot of issues. We really appreciate y'all and appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thank you all for joining us for this live recording of Dressed. May you consider why fashion history matters next time you get dressed.
Dress listeners, there is one spot left on our fashion history tour of Paris. So this trip sold out very quickly. And we are actually considering adding a second week if we have enough interest. So we don't really want to add it and get people's hopes up if we don't fill it up. So the dates for this second week would be October 12th through the 19th. And if that sounds of interest to you, please reach out to us at hello@dresshistory.com to reserve your spot. And dresshistory.com is our website, as you know, where you'll find information on our upcoming fashion history tours, classes, anything else we have up our sleeves, including part two of my What Women Wore to the Revolution class, which I am going to be posting any day now. And I am so excited to announce that I'm actually adding a book club element to part two of this class. So once a month after the class, we're going to be meeting to discuss a book, and that may or may not include some special guests, including authors of who and what we are going to read. So join.
Also, if you would like to join me, you can do so in New York City via one of my Fashion History Fridays at the Met. So many of you have booked this week's tour on Fridays, looking quite robust. And also, a lot of you have approached me about doing private tours for you at times that I don't necessarily have on my schedule on Fridays. So I am more than happy to do that for you guys. You can reach out to me and email me at hello@dresshistory.com, and we can start a conversation about that. You can also DM us on Instagram if you'd like to reach out at @dressed_podcast, which is, of course, where you will find images and reels accompanying each week's episodes. If you'd like to find the Instagram content specifically connected to this episode, check out the #dressed363. That's #dressed363.
And remember, you can find an array of our favorite and podcast featured fashion history titles on the Dress Bookshelf through bookshop.org. You can also find a link to our bookshelf in our show notes, as well as a link to sign up for the ad-free version of the show, which is just $3 a month and supports two of your favorite podcasters. As always, thank you so much for your continued support. More Dress coming your way next week. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.